Beloved congregation of our Lord Jesus Christ, as I've done all along, we continue to use as our main theme for this series on Esther that phrase, hidden but present, to refer to really God's activity in the book of Esther. There's the fact that God is never mentioned explicitly by name. In that sense, he's perhaps hidden, and yet we see his fingerprints and his activity all throughout the book as he aligns everything and arranges everything just so for his people to be saved. It's all true. It's all that we've noticed before. But of course, more should be said. Because when we look at the book of Esther, that's only part of the equation. And it's only part of the tension within the book. For if we just imagine that the book was a little bit different, and that it was the story about Esther and Mordecai, and just their rise to power at the Persian court, without any resistance, without any trouble, sure, God could still be hidden and but present, yet, that probably wouldn't bother us that much. We'd say, like, look, just look at their rapid rise and say, of course, the Lord is behind that, isn't it great? Their peace and their prosperity would just be a sign of God's presence. But that's not what the life of Mordecai and Esther really is. God's hiddenness is very much in the contrast with the very presence and activity of wicked people like Haman, that enemy of the Jews. God's enemy is very present in this whole book and very active. But God seems more silent and quiet and just hidden. And that, of course, gets us probably all thinking about our experience of this world. So we may have times, too, where we look at the world and say, like, well, it's pretty clear as where to God's enemies are active and what they're doing and all of their plans. But what is the Lord doing? And in the face of that, how do we respond? How do we live our lives? And what does it mean to then trust that, no, the Lord may be hidden, but he is present? And those are some of the questions that we'll look at then this morning under that theme, hidden but present, working with wisdom and patience. Now, as we've read, after those 3 days of fasting, the moment is finally there where Esther has to go to the king to really plead, intercede for his people, for God's people. So she dons her royal robe. She is going to appear before the king as queen with every reminder, basically, of who she is for the king himself. Esther had said already in the last chapter, if I perish, I perish. She didn't seem very positive about what would happen when she appears before the king. Well, now she is going to find out, is she going to perish or not? And we read how she enters the court and the king is in his hall and on his throne. There has been ancient depictions of the throne room of Persian kings, and some of them will have like the throne right there, king sitting on it, and an axeman right beside it. We don't know if an axeman was there that day or if that's what Xerxes did as well, but we know that the tension is there. That if someone comes before the Lord and they're unsummoned, they might just get the axe. The king holds power over life and death for anyone who dares to disturb him. And so what will it be for Esther, life or death? We read that she appears, he sees him. When he saw Queen Esther standing in the court, he was pleased with her and held out to her the gold scepter that was in his hand. And so Esther approached and touched the tip of the scepter. Esther lives. The king is actually pleased with her. This part of the plan so far has worked. Just as in, of course, in the rest of the book, the Lord isn't mentioned here. But of course, we recognize that the only reason that the king may be pleased also with her is that the Lord is at work. This isn't a coincidence. It's all starting to come together so far. And so Xerxes is pleased with Esther. But of course, he's probably also wondering, okay, so why is Esther showing up all of a sudden? Why would she risk her life like that to come into my presence? What is so important that may be worth risking her life? What may she be seeking? And so he has that request there. He says, just let me know what your request is. I will grant it to you, even up to half of my kingdom. It'll be yours. We've read that this king is generous, but not always. This time, he shows his generosity again to Esther. Just tell me, I will give it to you. Whatever your wish is, it will be granted. But Esther has only this request for now. If it pleases the king, let the king, together with Haman, come today to a banquet I have prepared for him. And throughout this story, we're going to notice that Esther is very patient, also very cautious. We'll say that she's wise. I mean, her life has been spared. That is amazing, but she still doesn't see quite the opportunity to now share with the king what her main plea is going to be. We're first going to have a couple more banquets, which shouldn't surprise us in the book of Esther because it's full of banquets, and we know Xerxes loves banquets. And so his response isn't that surprising either. He's right away asking for servants to get Haman so that he can go to this banquet. Of course, he must realize that that's not what Esther had risked her life for, just to have dinner and wine with the king. But it's probably intrigued now. What is this? Maybe I'll find out at the banquet. So we read, they start drinking, and they have their meal, and Xerxes asks again, okay, so now what is your request? What is your petition? It will be given to you, even up to half the kingdom, it will be granted. And again, the king promises generosity, and again, he tries to put Esther at ease, saying, and whatever you ask, it will be given to you. But Esther delays again. She says, just note my petition, and my request is this, if the king regards me with favor, and it pleases the king to grant my petition and fulfill my request, let the king and Haman come tomorrow to the banquet I will prepare for them. Then I will answer the king's question. Still not going to open up just yet. She invites the king and Haman to another banquet before she's even going to reveal what truly is the matter. Now, as those who were here last week may know, we're starting to get to the book where Esther really is taking up her spot as the main character within this book. Instead of maybe being more passive, now she becomes more active. She's actively seeking to save God's people. And of course, she is brave, courageous, as she enters the king's throne room in those full regal vestments, not knowing if she's going to be able to walk out alive. 3 days they've been preparing before putting her life at risk. And still, Esther went through with it. She put her life in the balance, in the hands of the king, or maybe more accurately, she put her life in the hands of the Lord to see whether or not she would actually live. She has to lay her life down before she can even pick it back up, before she can have that scepter reach out to her. And of course, that gets us, as Christians, thinking of another Savior. Of course, has to lay down his life. In his case, of course, not. He had to perish. He wasn't spared death, not at least for 3 days. Now, it is interesting that even Esther prepares for 3 days in uncertainty, in darkness in many ways, before she may have finally that confirmation that she gets to live, that she wouldn't perish. We shouldn't maybe push the fact that it happened after 3 days too much, but it is striking that in Jewish Midrash, which is just Jewish commentary on the Old Testament, It actually, there, some of the commentators would confess, saying, you know, the Lord has always worked this way. He never lets his people in dire, dark situations for more than 3 days. They looked at events in Abraham's life and at Jacob and in Jonah, and they see that pattern of three a bunch of times. Or they looked at Hosea 6, verse 2, where again the Lord promises that, yes, 3 days, but then I will raise you back up again. Whether we look at that three as foreshadowing Jesus Christ or not, it's that reminder for the church and for all believers. You know what? The church, Christians, all those living for God have had to face sometimes very dark days, sometimes multiple dark days, but the darkness never lasted forever. God sent deliverance. God extended life supremely in Jesus Christ. And This then allows Esther to become that mediator for her people. She risks her life, but she gains access to the king. And of course, that also anticipates what Jesus is going to do for us. Saving us from the wrath of God, of course, but for his case, he wasn't doing it for his perfect, innocent people. Christ had to risk his life for us who deserved judgment to save us from God's judgment himself. But this is what we can see also, what the Jews learned from Esther and what we can learn today. That as we look to the gospel of Christ's resurrection, it is for us the same thing as it was that when Esther was able to live. There's a hope, there's a chance that now we may live because our mediator lives. That as long as our mediator lives, we will be fine. And Esther, that may not have been as sure, but with Christ, the Lord does exactly that. Because she is a mediator, but it also means that, yes, she may live now, but that means that her mission is only just begun. Because her mission is to save God's people. It's not to just walk out of the throne room alive. And she's going to do that with patience, with wisdom, and with tact. And we'll discuss that more just a little bit near the end of the sermon. But especially because we can contrast that with Haman. But perhaps we're wondering, as we read this, okay, so why is Esther doing what she's doing? Why this stall tactic, if you want to call it that way? Why this patience? I mean, the king is already offering his kingdom. Isn't she just going to annoy him if she doesn't bring it up? How is the king going to respond to this? Surely she has the opportunity now, right then, to save God's people. There are probably a couple of reasons for what Esther is doing, what she's doing, everything coming together to make for that wise decision. Good chance it fits in the court customs. You know, don't be rude and direct. Kind of play the game of negotiation and keep the king intrigued. Draw him in. Depending on the culture that we live in, maybe we would more appreciate people being direct with us. Just say it, what you're thinking and what you want, then we can deal with it. But that's not the case in every culture. And Esther would have been probably aware of that as well. Moreover, while Esther waits, she is getting the king to promise that he will offer to her whatever she wants, not once, not even twice, but three times by the time that she finally shares her request with him. And by that third time in chapter 7, it would have been very, very difficult for the king to start really retreating or start to going back on his promises. I mean, three times he says, it doesn't matter what you ask, up to half the kingdom, I will give it to you. Can't just start backtracking all of a sudden. Servants know it. Haman knows it. Esther knows it. She's getting the king right where she wants him so that she may make her request. Just lining up everything as much as she humanly can to get the result that she wants. And as we'll see, this is of course just what the Lord is going to use to then also bring salvation for his people. But before we get to see that, the book shifts again to Haman in the rest of chapter 5. Because Haman is delighted. I mean, he's on top of the world because he just had the opportunity to have really the king and the queen for himself. They're at a banquet, not just one day, but 2 days in a row. And it is good to be Haman. But as he's heading home from this banquet, his eye catches Mordecai again because he's at the palace gate. And this time, it's not so much that he didn't bow. Now he didn't rise or show him any honor. And Haman can't stand it. He can barely contain his rage, but he just does that and goes off home. That Mordecai, he'll show him. And so when he gets home, maybe to let out some of the frustration, he goes on this ego trip. He calls his family and he calls his wife and friends and he recounts to them all the accomplishments of his life. He boasts about his wealth. Just imagine, right, he put so much silver in the coffers of the king, it was worth a good chunk of the taxes of the whole kingdom. He boasts about his sons because he had 10 of them. It's like his own mini army. He had all of his accomplishments of his life. He was the highest in all of the kingdom. Now he had the honor of the king and he seems to get the honor of the queen. All of it just puts him at the top of his life and ability. But as much as he boasts in all of those things, he then also right away says, actually, you know what? It doesn't give me any pleasure. It just brings me no satisfaction as long as I see that Jew Mordecai sitting there in the gate. But no worries, his counselors have also some advice and a solution to that problem. Just build a gallows 675 feet high, ask the king in the morning to just deal then with Mordecai, and go ahead and enjoy your banquet. Problem solved. We know Haman loves the idea. He loves it even so much that in the next chapter, it seems like he's, you know, as soon as the sun is up, he's at the king's court to ask for just that. So here we have Haman. Now keep in mind that this is Haman in his prime, like his peak in this whole story. Because after 6 verse 4, things are going to change very rapidly for him. It's really only downhill after 6 verse 1. Because 6 verse 1, as we'll look at in a couple weeks, is actually the literary center of the book, which is very telling as well. But we'll look at that then. So this is Haman at his peak. And he seems to know it and want to tell everyone about it. Just look at all that I've accomplished. All of this lifetime of accomplishments and now getting to dine with the king and queen. And yet, it's so interesting because as much as he's at the peak of his life, he says, I cannot enjoy it as long as Mordecai is alive. He can't enjoy it as long as there's one person out there who stands there to defy him and does not bow or does not rise to show him honor. Even at his peak, Haman just seems so fragile. And that shouldn't surprise us as Christians, because when we put our hope in idols, whatever it may be, power, wealth, honor, or all of them together as Haman does, we're building our life and our identity and even our self-worth really on sand. And you are going to be fragile and insecure as long as you live. Haman can't be at peace as long as his self-worth is and his joy and his peace is based on the actions and opinions of other people, and as long as it's not on the Lord God himself. God, through Mordecai, exposes Haman for being fragile, and even in his prime, as just a proud and petty man. And talk about a stark warning, because God warns us that, yeah, you may even be in your prime and you can boast about all of your accomplishments, but you'll always be on shaky grounds if you do not trust in him or do not rely on him. And if you get a sense of there's some foreboding, some like ominous, there's something bad is going to happen to Haman, yes, of course. Because that fragility is going to show, because within 24 hours that can all change. Because he did not build on the Lord, rely on him. So, of course, Haman is worried about that, and he should be, because he has no firm foundation. Now, I mentioned already that at 6 verse 1, that literary turning point, the center of the book. And the book of Esther is then therefore also written in such a way that as we lead up to that point, 6 verse 1, we focus on Esther and then Haman. And then after that point, it's Haman and Esther again. A nice cross or chiasm, as they would call it in English. And one of the things that it does is contrast the Lord's working, on the one hand, through Esther and what he's all doing as he positions everyone just where he wants them to be, with what Haman does and the way Haman lives and the intrigues of his enemy. And what we see is something that really just adds to the depth of what Esther is doing. As we already said, tact, patience, and quiet, and indirect. Because yes, Esther is courageous and bold as she enters the throne room, but also very wise right after that, just waiting for the opportunity to come. And it stands out because it is very similar to actually how the Lord works throughout this book. You see Esther at work. Patience, getting maybe the king just where she wants him to be. And it gets you to think about how the Lord, all the way from the beginning, has just gotten people in the right positions as he wanted them to be. Vashti disappears. Esther gets into the place. Mordecai is just there to overhear with the plot of the assassins. And it goes on and on. Every time, just so. the right people, in the right time, the right spot. The Lord reveals His wisdom by doing all things just that way, lining everything up to save His people. And Esther's wisdom, tact, and patience just reflect in some ways the Lord's own work in this book. And this contrasts so much with Haman. Because you read Haman in this chapter and he's obnoxious. Especially in this chapter, he's loud. As we imagine him gathering his fans all around him to then go on and on about all of his exploits. He's petty. He can't have any satisfaction without, well, Mordecai is still there. He doesn't have any patience. I mean, remember, the death warrant for Mordecai was already signed. It's going to happen in a couple months. But no, Haman can't wait for that. And his advisors and Haman are as settled as a brick, because what they decide is, well, you know what to do? Get rid of him, not in a discreet way, not in just with patience or anything like it. No, just, you know, do it tomorrow and build a 75-foot gallows or stake so that the whole city may know that Mordecai was that one guy who you couldn't stand. In some strange way, Haman is able to despise Mordecai and put him to death, yet also in some way, weird way, almost exalt him by making him the special focus of all of his wrath, by putting him just above the city. But all of it, all of Haman's response combined, just covers up his lack of peace and his lack of control. He just can't find any rest, even while he's at the top of the world. Top of the world in every other aspect of life. So I've kept that theme hidden but present to describe God's working in this book. Because He is certainly at work, even in this chapter, but quietly, maybe more in the background. And it contrasts so clearly with how the Lord works, or how the enemies of the Lord work, like Haman. So we can just imagine that one of the difficulties for both Esther and Mordecai is that, you know, the Lord may be hidden, but evil is so present. It's loud, it's active, and obnoxious. And yet when you boil it down like that, isn't that also what sometimes living in this world can feel like? Can you think of any loud, obnoxious enemies of the church or Christians today or in the past 50 years, in the centuries before that? You know, just people who are enemies of what Christianity stands for, and they push and push in direct hostility of God's word and anyone who would believe in it. Some of them even gaining power and influence and yet always not being satisfied because they want to use that power and influence to make sure that everyone will bow to their agenda. And if something comes to mind, I mean, we could talk about that, but in some ways, maybe it's better to just also keep it general. Because do we think that today is any different than it has been in the past? Or you look at what Esther and Mordecai are dealing with and how it actually relates to today. These things are always going to come around. It's going to be here maybe today. We'll be here probably a decade from now as well. God's enemies are always going to be at work. They're just going to be loud and obnoxious and probably also fragile in the meantime. And God may be described as hidden but present, working in the background to bring then His kingdom and protect His people. But His enemies will always have that very different tactic and very different present within the world. But of course, I raise the question, then, okay, so how are we to respond to that? What are we called to do? In the face of those noise, in the face of those pressures, the constant attempt of advancement of God's opponents. And of course, the temptation probably is for all of us to be loud and obnoxious in return. Be impetuous, be direct, do as they do, fight fire with fire. They're going to be loud on social media, then we should be louder. If they are laughing at us in different ways and at our expense and different jokes, then we're going to do it just back. And yet this is where you look at what the Lord does through Esther. Yes, she is bold and she is courageous and she risks her life, very direct in what she does. But at the same time, she's no Joan of Arc that she dons armor and then goes out to fight all of God's enemies one-on-one. She's no Moses who's there with signs and power and authority saying, listen to me, I'm going to save God's people. Instead, all that God does in the book of Esther is give her that position of queen and say, now act as one. Fulfill your calling as queen and use it to the benefit of my people. Do it with wisdom. Do it with patience. Do it with tact. But that's what I'm asking you to do. Now, the book of Esther is a little bit different, of course, because as we get to the end of the end of the book, they are going to be violent and they are going to in some ways fight fire with fire as they deal with God's enemy. But again, we should probably think of that as part of their calling still at the time. So we've looked at that, how the story continues. They were called to deal with the Amalekites of their day. But for most part, it's just the Lord doesn't do miraculous signs. He doesn't do miraculous works. He just works through, most part, Esther and Mordecai, who fulfill their calling with patience and wisdom. And of course, they are anticipating how the Lord is going to work for us also through Jesus Christ. The prophets have these amazing visions and prophecies about who Jesus is going to be. He's going to be one who comes as a warrior. He's one who comes to bring, finally, justice and righteousness to the world. And that is why so many people, when Jesus appeared, thought, hey, now he's going to fight all of our enemies and we should join him. We should start donning our armor. But also at other times, the prophets realized, actually, no, when the servant of the Lord's going to come, he's going to come very meek and mild. He's not going to lift his voice up in the street. And he's not going to break a bruised reed or snuff out a smoldering wick. He's actually going to bring justice and righteousness by being very humble. Very humble. Quiet, subtle, but with power, purpose, and wisdom. That's in the example that he set for the rest of his kingdom. This is the example that he set to us. As he says, that is our calling for today. For us to consider where the Lord has placed us, what position we have received from him, and to see how we can serve him there with, yes, power, the Spirit, and with wisdom and patience and purpose. Because, yes, we know the world will be loud, there will be opponents that will rage, but don't let that sidetrack you or overwhelm you. Because God is still present, and he works through his people that he's put in this world for the advancement of his kingdom and for his glory and for our salvation. And that just often just means making the most of the calling that God has given each one of us. No, parents, I know you may worry, okay, so what is going to happen when all of these enemies of the Lord rage and my kids will have to face them when they grow up? You're not going to have the perfect answer, but if you take your calling serious to raise them up with patience and wisdom and the fear of the Lord, don't we expect God to bless that? Is that how often he just simply works through this world? That's why the New Testament so often reminds us, saying, like, let all of your interactions with unbelievers or people around you be full of wisdom, tact, and honesty. So that even if they rage and they do say things against you, they really don't have any leg to stand on because you are one person of integrity. Because it's like Peter says, there will be little that people will be able to throw back at us if we do good. And the same is like within this world or in this country. We just have a calling as citizens to live as God's people. And just being at our post wherever God has placed us and to do that with wisdom and patience. Because if we try to match the world, which we won't ever be able to do, the danger is that we just blend in with the world. But if we work by the Spirit of Christ in wisdom and patience, the world will actually get a sense that God is present in the world. Because he's working through his people. So if we're eager to want to do something when the world turns hostile, the challenge is just for us to double down on what God has called us to do, the calling that he's placed before us. To do that with wisdom and patience. And we shouldn't be of course, naive, we know also from Esther's example that that sometimes may bring very difficult decisions and dark, dark days. But it reminds us that those also won't last forever. And we're not called to try and match the world in its noise or even in its power. But rather, God places the calling on us to do what we do with wisdom and patience. Amen.